As you can probably guess, I drew the short straw. I have to give this presentation. This presentation will cover some examples of fast transfer in ICS. Oh, by the way, I'm Joseph Warren. I'm a principal engineer in the exchange team. And the agenda for this presentation is to a couple examples of fast transfer, copying messages from the server to the client, copying messages from the server to a client up to another server. Different scenarios, say the client wants to copy messages locally down to a PST, it would do a server to client copy. And if it wanted to copy messages between mailboxes, it would do a server to client to server. Or if it wanted to copy messages between a mailbox and public folders, or between public folders. And also kind of describe the difference between actually copying messages with fast transfer and how you can actually move messages with fast transfer. In the ICS examples, I'll discuss how the client detects whether or not the content within a folder is changed and whether or not a folder needs to be synchronized down to a cache client. Some of the Outlook devs are in the back of the room, so they'll keep me honest, make sure I'm giving good information. And also an example of how, what it looks like on the wire to actually download a new message using ICS. Okay, so fast transfer examples. First one is copy messages from server client. So essentially here, the client initiates the copy by doing a fast transfer source copy message operation. And it does this on an open folder object. So prior to this ROP, you have to do a ROP open folder. You get back the folder object, and on the folder object, you can issue the fast transfer source copy message object. And in the response to this ROP, it'll actually return a download fast transfer context object. And then the client can use the fast transfer source get buffer to actually start tell the server to start serializing the messages in which the client wants to download. And then the client will just repetitively keep calling the get buffer to get more and more and more of that stream until the stream is done. The very last get buffer, there's a flag in the response to tell the client that there's no more data from this stream. And then the client will issue a ROP release to release the fast transfer context object. And of course, if you're a server developer, you'll appreciate that all clients should call ROP release on objects when they're no longer used. And then after that, the client can then take that data that it downloaded and parse it and interpret it and consume the data in whatever way it wants. So in this example, I selected two messages in an inbox and I copied them to a PST file. I used NetMonitor or NetMon to capture the traffic. Of course, encryption was turned off, so I could actually see something. And I examined the data with our RPX tool, which will take a NetMon capture and then break out all the data on the wire for exchange. So, as I described earlier, the client will first issue a ROP fast transfer copy message operation. I'm not really going to get into talking about the RPC header. Daryl kind of covered that in his talk and how to parse that and how that header is defined. The values here are what the RPX tool outputs. In this particular example, the data was XORed, and it's the last block in the request going up to the server. But the first ROP in the ROP payload is the copy messages ROP, and it contains two messages that I want to copy, and their message IDs, and the fact that the client also wants all the properties to be returned in Unicode, and what else is there of interest? The copy flags is zero. Generally, I think the copy flags is only two values. It's zero or one. One means that the client is trying to issue a move, and zero means that it's doing a copy. In this example, I was copying the data. And also in the same request, went up to the server. The client asks for the first serialized buffer. I've got arrows. The header, and here in the fast transfer source get buffer, you have babe. I'll explain babe here really quick. Some people have asked what it means. It's interesting. Why babe? Babe was kind of invented at the same time we were doing chained buffers in the response, and we needed a way to actually more optimally tell the server to return the data. Because normally in the raw fast transfer source get buffer, you specify the buffer size of how much data you want to return. And the server was very strict about it. If it couldn't actually fit that exact amount in the response, it would actually return a raw buffer too small. So it would return the request back to the client, tell the client to reallocate the buffer or send up a request with a larger alpha buffer. We didn't like this because it was causing additional RPCs, so we came up with a mechanism to actually tell the server, hey, just give me as much as will fit in the response buffer up to a certain size. So we had to have a sentinel value, so we picked BABE for buffer after buffer extension, because that was the feature that we were working on at the time. And then we added a value after it, the maximum buffer size. It just says don't go over this if there's any more room. Don't go beyond this. Because if you're implementing a client, you more than likely have a fixed buffer size that you want to copy this data into. So you don't want the server to give you too much that you can handle. The Outlook client seems to always pass 31680.
Joe, are you confident this works?
Yeah. What's that?
Are you confident this works? That the maximum buffer size is really small value? That it return no more than that?
Am I confident that the server will do this?
Yeah.
Yes. Sort of. prior to Exchange 2010, I'm confident that it works. In Exchange 2010, I think there's a, we don't work well if you go under 16K. But the Outlook client always asks for 31680. We haven't run into a problem. But if you are running a client, maybe a client on a very small device with very little memory and you want very little data at a time, we might not work well. And that has a lot to do with the way we get the data from the back end and we package it up. Well, let me step back. It'll work well for copy operations, like copy messages, copy to, copy folder, but it won't work well for ICS. And ICS, I believe it has to be larger than 16K. But memory's cheap. Ask for the max. Also in this example, so in the response from the server comes back and responds to the source copy messages. It succeeds, it creates an object, returns the object. It also returns the first serialized buffer from the get buffer response. And here in the RPX tool, it gives you the actual hex data of the ROP. A lot of good juicy stuff in there, and I'll explain how that can be parsed. In most of my slide decks, I actually removed a lot of the data just because it would take hundreds of slides to actually show all this data. So anywhere where it says data removed or truncated is where data has actually been removed. And in subsequent slides, a lot of the ROP data I've truncated or completely removed just because it's cleaner on the screen. So in this actual response buffer, this is the actual buffer, the first buffer that comes back in the source get buffer. This is the fast transfer data. This does not contain the ROP information or the extended buffer header. This is just the raw ROP data in that response. This data is, my previous talk, if you were here, I talked about how the format of this data is in the buffer. I didn't really talk too much about how it actually is parsed. When you first start parsing the data, you want to look, everything is based off of a property tag. So the first thing that you're going to want to do is parse the property tag. And a property tag is 4 bytes. And that's what we call the minimum atom that's in the stream. So the first thing you're going to do is you're going to look for 4 bytes. And it's either going to be a marker or it's going to be a property. And in this case, it's the start message marker saying, following this marker in the stream is a message. The significance of the atoms is when the data is put into the response buffer, atoms can't be broken across multiple RPC calls or multiple get buffer calls. It has to either completely fit or it doesn't include it at all, and it will wait for the next request. So in this case, I had a big buffer, so it fit. We had the start message marker, and then we read the next value after it, which is the PID tag mid, which is the mid of the message. This property actually is not a marker, it's a property, so we have to honor the actual property type. We have to read the actual data of the property. So this is an int 64, so there's going to be 8 bytes following it for the data for the property. And since properties like strings and binary properties, those are variable length properties, but everything else is a fixed size property, so that that property data is considered an atom itself and it has to completely fit within the buffer. So the next chunk is the actual data for that int 64, and it's an atom. It has to fully fit in the buffer. And once we've read the property value, we just assume that the next value is going to be another marker or another tag. So we read the next tag, and it's the property PID tag importance. It's the importance property on the message. And then it's an int 32, so we assume that there's going to be another 4 bytes after the data for that message. Value of 1, this goes on and so forth. We go to the next property, it's an actual a string, message class, the Unicode string, strings. I didn't really go into all the different property types in this talk, but strings consist of the actual property tag, followed by the size of the string, which is also another atom, and then the actual data of the string. So we assume that since this is a string, the next atom after it is going to be the length. We parse that out, and we get the length of the string, and then we actually then try to read the string value for the 18 bytes. I don't think it's the number of Unicode characters, but it's the actual physical byte length. Now the actual string, since this is a variable length property, this can actually be broken anywhere in that string. It doesn't have to be solely contained in this request or in this response. It can actually be broken anywhere in there, whether it's before the first byte or right before the last byte, it can be broken. The server doesn't have to honor any sort of boundaries there. And the client needs to know that when he's parsing the value of that string, that he might not have all of it. He has to wait, get more data, and continue with the rest of that string. So once it's done with the string, it goes on to the next atom. And this goes on, same thing, gets another 4-byte property. And that's roughly how you parse the fast transfer stream. The whole thing is property, and if it's a marker, it tells you, gives you some instructional information on what follows. If it's a property, you normally have to read the data after it. And that's basically the way to kind of just parse that fast transfer stream out. Now, what you can do with this, the RPX tool does a good job of actually breaking this down for you. It'll actually tell you what's in that fast transfer stream. And this example here, what I showed before, there's the start message marker, the mid property, and then a bunch of folder or a bunch of message properties. And then eventually, if you parse through it farther, we would get to a start recipient marker. This wraps individual recipients of the message, and then eventually the end message marker. In my previous talk last time, the flow of the fast transfer source copy message was essentially presented as this: start message, the mid property had to exist right after that start message marker, and then all other message properties followed by the individual recipients with the start recip, end recip, and then new attach if there's attachments. In this example, I didn't have any attachments in the message, So we don't actually see that in the data stream. So as you can see, this follows that format quite well. The star recipient properties in recipient and message. So the key takeaway here is that you could actually write a parser for the FastTrans regime that just tokenizes everything into atoms and property values, and you can essentially just kind of build this property bag view of what's going across the wire. Now, once the client receives this information, you can write logic to handle this. In essence, what Outlook would do is, for each individual message, it would create a new message in the PST, it would set the message properties, and then if it received the start recipient, it would create a new recipient object, it would set the recipient properties, and then finally, when it got down to the end message, that's essentially where we'd call save changes on that message and save it into the PST. Likewise, I guess I'll talk about it a little bit more on the server to client to server example, but if the server is receiving this property or this stream, it essentially would do the same thing. It would create a message, set its properties, create recipients, save the message.
Is there an easy way to distinguish between markers and regular property type sets?
Other than the fact that we have a list that says these are markers, okay. There's no real way.
Okay.
Fortunately, I don't know why, but markers also have property types. Some of them will say they're INT32s, some will say they're binary, but there's no data after them,
Yeah. Which
is confusing, I know. So if you see a marker, there's no data after it.
So I pretty much always have to compare to this list of non-markers.
It's not a big list, I think there's maybe 30. So the next example is server to client to server. And I explained before, some of the newer, fancier Outlook versions, you can have multiple mailboxes open, or if you want to copy between public folders and your private mailbox, or vice versa. This is roughly how the client can achieve that. So essentially here, it's very similar to downloading the messages to the client. But the client then is going to want to turn around and take that raw data stream that it got and pass it back up to another server. So essentially, he initiates reading the messages from the source server with another source copy messages, with a list of messages that it wants to copy. Now, in my examples, I'm using copy messages. There's other copy operations. There's like copy folder. If a client wanted to copy a folder down to the client or copy it from one server to another, he would use a different raw. But in these examples, I'm just copying a handful or a couple messages. So it's using copy messages. So the source server will return the fast transfer download context. The client will then initiate an upload session with the destination server by issuing a raw fast transfer destination copy configure. The destination copy configure will basically handle any type of upload. There isn't specific raws for different like copy messages or copy folder. There's just one. And inside the payload of that request ROP, it'll say what type of operation that client is trying to push up. The destination server will return a fast transfer upload context object. And then the client plays this middleman role where he will do the source get buffer request and pull data down from the source server, and then call destination put buffer and pass that buffer up to the destination server. So this example, I selected a group of messages and copy them between two mailboxes. I believe it was three messages. And again, I used Netmon to capture the data, and I used our RPX tool to dump the data. This looks very much like the previous one, except that there's an additional ROP that's added into the request buffer. It first starts the source copy messages, and it passes a list of three messages. There's a slight difference here. I don't know if I have a little arrow to... I don't. You'll notice in the send options of the copy messages, instead of just saying Unicode, enforce Unicode, it also uses this use CPID flag, which essentially tells the source server that this data is going to be uploaded to another server. The reason for this flag originally was so that the server... could leave data more, could transmit the data in a slightly different fashion because it knows that the client wasn't going to be consuming the data, that it could actually just pass the data in some raw format. And this is usually only in when it's transmitting string properties. String properties, normally when they're downloaded to the client, there's a certain property type, whether it's a string 8 or Unicode string. But when you're going server to server, the server can actually transmit the string properties in a more of a native string type that includes the code page of the string. When it's transferring it down to the client, it converts all the strings to the code page in which the client wants the strings as. In Outlook 2007 and above, I believe it always asks for Unicode. But prior to that, the server would have to convert it to whatever the code page is on the logon of the mailbox. But when it's going server to server, the server can actually just say, well, I'm not going to convert this to the code page of the client because the client's not going to consume the data. I'm going to keep it as full fidelity as possible and transmit the strings in the native format that includes code page. The server also, or the client also tells the source server the version of the destination server. And that's done with the ROPTEL version. The ROPTEL version is an operation that goes on the download context object that's created in the source copy messages ROP. Why is that important? Why does the source server need to know the version of the destination? Today it's really not that important. We kind of got rid of some functionality. What it used to be used for is that if the source server knew that it's communicating with a destination server by the use of the use CPID flag, and the version of the source server and the destination server were exactly the same, it could assume that the destination server had the same logic to computed properties and such, and then it's so that when it serialized the message, it could strip out a bunch of properties that are computed properties that the destination server doesn't need because it's going to compute them exactly the same way. What it was thinking is that both servers were exchanged, they're both exactly the same version, we could kind of cheat a little bit and not transmit as much data on the wire. In Exchange 2010, we kind of got rid of that optimization. We said, oh, that's kind of, you know, maybe not every server is going to be Exchange. We got rid of that, and the fast transfer stream coming out of Exchange 2010 is always just all the properties. There's no real optimizations around that. And then lastly, in the request buffer going up to the source server is the first get buffer, telling the server to, hey, give me some data. And it's using the vague flag again, of course, and the max data size, since this is Outlook, is 31,680. So the response looks something like this. Actually, we have multiple response buffers, or packed buffers, as we like to call it, in the response. So you're going to have multiple headers, and each one of them is going to have different flags and size value. So the first three response buffers are compressed, so their size and size actual are slightly different. The size is the compressed value, the size actual is the uncompressed value. Now the client asked for, what was it? It asked for 31,680. So some of the sizes here look a little bit bigger than 31,680 because there's the overhead of the actual raw data itself in the HSOT table. And then the last buffer is a bit smaller, and it's also compressed, but it's the last buffer in that chain, in that response. So let's see. So inside of here in the response, you get the response to the source copy messages. You get the response to the ROPTEL version. Everything succeeds. It returns status code or return value of 0. And then you get the first response to the first to the source get buffer. The data in here, the transfer status is partial. It means it's the first chunk. It means it's not the entire fast transfer stream, but it's the first chunk. And the amount of data that's returned is 31,680. That's the transfer buffer size of the ROP. And of course, I removed the data. In their second one, since this is a chained response, it's only the last ROP can be chained. Only certain ROPs can be chained like this. We have another fast transfer source get buffer response. It's a continuation of the previous one. It's dated. Its status is partial, meaning here's the next chunk, but it is not the end. And it's another 31,680. It's kind of funny how the breaking always seems to work exactly at 31,680. You think that there'd be some weird, like it wouldn't fit everything exactly byte for byte, but it seems to be the case. The next one is the exact same. It's another continuation. It's another partial. It's not complete. Another 31,680 bytes of data. And in the last one, we don't get a full buffer. There wasn't as much data left in the response. The way the packing works is the client requests, I think, 96K of output buffer. The server will fit in the first 32K in the first RPC header of 32K of data, and then it will compress it, and then it will do another 32K, compress it, and so on and so forth. And we could fit four of them in the response in the 96K that was requested. The last one, the residual space was less than 32K, so it fit as much as it could because it used the babe flag. It fit up to roughly, I don't know, 16K, 17K. And it's partial. So this isn't the complete stream. There's actually still more data. Partial. So the client then takes this data, and now it's initiating going up to the destination server. So it does the destination copy configure. It's in the says it's a copy messages operation inside the request payload there. The copy flag is also zero, so it's telling the destination that it's not a move, it's just a copy. Now, the client also tells the destination the version of the source server. It does another ROP tell version on the destination context object, and it says, here's the version of the source, and that's the whole game that I explained where the source server can emit properties, but the destination server needs to know that the source server is emitting those properties. Now this particular version, this is the same three-word version that comes back from the ECDO Connect EX. So if you're wondering what version do I use there, it's the version that you get back. So when the client connects to the source server, he gets back the source server's version, and he connects to the destination server, he gets back the destination server version. You essentially just pass those same three-word version in the ROP tell version. You can take the three-word version values, and there's the RPC document has an algorithm. I have to normalize that to a four-digit exchange version. In this case, I'm using version 15.0.116.4000. So this is an early version of the 15 server. Don't worry, there's nothing different in the protocol yet. Okay. And then, of course, it's going to pass up the first put buffer that it got from the source. So it got that big chained response from the source and had four buffers in it. The client says, well, I'm making a call to the destination server. I might as well pass the first buffer up to the destination server. So it passes up the first buffer, which is 31,680 in bytes, so that the server can optimally effectively use that RPC call and not have to make multiple RPC calls. Now, we allow chaining for downloading ROPs from the source server, but today we don't allow chaining of ROPs up to the destination server. So what you'll see is the client will get a whole bunch of data from the source server, then it has to make multiple RPC calls to the destination to push that, and then it goes back to the source server and gets a large chunk from the source server. I'm not saying in the future we won't change this, but currently there wasn't the need to push up a lot of data. We found that the client, in the cache mode scenario, synchronized down far more data than it needed to push up. So there wasn't really a need to optimize going the other way. So in response, the server comes back. It succeeds on the destination copy config or destination configure. So it returns us an upload context object. The ROPTEL version succeeds. Don't know of any case in which it could fail. But the destination buffer comes back and says, thank you very much. I've digested 31680. The buffer's used size says how much of the buffer that it's used. Don't be fooled by this. I think the server always just tells you that it used all of it. There's no, oh, the server didn't use all of it. I better resend data. It's not like any sort of windowing that's going on here. The server will always just say, thank you, I used all of it. So the client will then make additional RPC calls to destination put buffer to put up all of that data that it got in the one call to the source server. So it's going to do another put buffer for the next buffer of 31680. I'm not showing the responses here, but we'll do another request to the destination server passing up the next 31680. And lastly, it'll do the last request pushing up the slightly around 16K of the last chunk of data. So now it's read and it's pushed. Now, if you wanted to get fancy in a client, you could essentially have multiple threads. You could be reading from the source independently of pushing to the target. And I'm not sure if Outlook does this or not. They might. But they're completely independent operations. You don't have to read and then wait to push. You could do some games there, since you're working with two different connections to two different servers. You're not going to be stepping on each other. So now the client will then turn around and it will go back to the source server and do another source get buffer to get the next chunk, the next set of buffers, because the last chunk and the first request returned partial, so it knows there's more data. And then it will turn around and take that and push it up to the destination server with the destination put buffer as before. So you get another request of a source get buffer. It uses BABE again. It always uses BABE. I think we should just hard code that now and not support the old version, because I don't think the client ever does the old version, any old way of doing it anymore. And of course, the client then returns another chunk of data. And in this case, the server only returned about 20K, 19K, I guess. And it says it's done. This is the last buffer in the stream. So the client knows that there's going to be no more. It doesn't have to go back and get another buffer. I should back up here. I should explain, if you're writing a server, expect that the client might actually issue another ROP source get buffer to the server, even if the server previously said it was done. What the server should do is say, oh, I was done. Just tell the client that you're done again and don't return any data. Just keep saying, I'm done, I'm done, I'm done. The reason for this is that the client wants to make proper use of the bandwidth on the wire. So it will actually issue a bunch of RPC calls in parallel, not in parallel, but in a pipeline. So that they're going up to the server kind of one right after the other, and the client doesn't wait for the response to the first one before it sends the next request. It does this to kind of speed up the throughput from the source server. So the source server has to be able to deal with the fact that it could get another request from the client doing a source get buffer when it's already said that it was done. So if you basically just return done again, of course, in the subsequent ones, you're not going to actually return any transfer buffer. The buffer size would be zero, and there'd be no data subsequent requests. So the client is then going to turn around and take that data, of course, that 19K that it got, and it's going to do the destination put buffer to the destination. And the destination server is going to return and say, thank you, I've digested it. Now, on the server, like the client, of course, he's going to parse out the stream that was passed up. It's totally up to your implementation if you want to wait until the entire stream is uploaded before you start parsing it, or you want to be parsing it as you're receiving chunks. I don't think there's any requirement that you have to do it one way or the other. In the Exchange server, I think we We parse it as we go. We don't like to keep large buffers around. But the server will process it kind of like the client did. It'll see the start message tag. It'll say, okay, now in this destination folder, I need to create a message. It'll set the properties that it parsed out. It'll set any recipients, any attachments that are in the stream. And then, of course, when it gets to the end message tag, it'll do a save changes. Now, there's multiple messages in that serialized data. It's going to actually create a message, save the message as it's going. So if you're watching the destination, you'd see the messages kind of all pop in at separate times. Now, moving messages. Now, moving messages is slightly different than copying messages, obviously, because it needs to actually, the source message needs to be deleted. Now, in fast transfer, this is a bit different. Normally, if you go to the server and you issue an operation like a raw copy messages, which is the non-fast transfer version, and you're just copying messages between folders, and if you think there's a flag on that ROP to say move, after it copies the data, it just deletes the messages from the source folder. The server owns both the source and the destination folder, and it doesn't have a problem deleting them. Now, in fast transfer, when you're copying the data, the client is now the middleman, the person in the middle. He grabs the data, pushes it. So he needs to be involved in the move process. A lot of words here. In a nutshell, when you're doing a move, the client actually can't just ignore the data. In the server-to-client-to-server scenario, it's essentially getting the data and then just pushing the data. But in the move scenario, the client actually has to parse the data as well. It has to kind of keep track of what messages have been flowing through me to the destination, or what messages have I been copying down into the PST. So he kind of loosely parses the stream. He might not be as interested as, say, the destination, but he has to parse through them to find the markers. So he'll parse through and he'll find a start message marker. Now, after the start message marker, as I previously explained, there's always the property, the mid property. There's the reason why that always has to come after the start message marker is because the client is looking for it in the stream as it's copying the data. So it will keep track of the mids that are flowing through the system. And whenever it gets to an end message marker, he says, okay, I've gotten the end of this message. So now when I push this buffer up to the destination that has the end for this message, I know the destination, when it processes the end, is going to commit that data into the database. So when it gets a successful response to the destination put buffer on a buffer that it knows it has an in message marker in it, it knows, okay, I'm now able to actually delete the message from the source server. So in the data stream between Outlook and Exchange, you'll see some source get buffers, you'll see some destination put buffers, and then you'll see these weird ROP delete messages calls kind of intermixed with source get buffer. And what the client's doing is it's just keeping track of the message that it successfully moved. And at the end of a destination put request, it says, oh, I have these messages. I'm going to delete them. Now, if there was multiple messages in a single buffer that it pushed to the destination, it keeps track of all those messages and it passes them all up in one ROP delete messages call. I don't know why it wasn't designed to just hold off and wait to the very end of the entire copy to just delete them all at once. Maybe the UI was a little bit weird in that case. If you wanted to move a bunch of messages, they would all just sit there for a long time and then all be deleted at once. This way, you can see some steady progress as it's going. It doesn't really interfere with the retrieving of the next buffer because the ROP deleted messages it's put into the request buffer in a deferred way in which that it also lumps in the next source get buffer ROP after it. So it's not impacting the number of RPC calls. So it shouldn't be any different than the copy message case. The last point here, and this is a flag that you pass on the ROP fast transfer source copy operation. There's the copy flags. As I explained before, it's either 0 or 1. On the source server, prior to Exchange 2010, the source server would always validate that who you are logged in at have permissions to actually delete each message. So as it's serializing the message, it'll say, oh, this is a move. So we know the client's going to come back and want to delete this. So it checks to make sure that you have delete permissions to delete the message. And if you don't, it just doesn't serialize the message. It actually skips it. It doesn't put it in the fast transfer stream. It actually will put a marker or a meta property in the stream that tells you that a message was skipped. In Exchange 2010, when we kind of broke up the architecture, we had a middle tier and a back end. We didn't implement this functionality. It doesn't actually validate that you have permissions to delete a message. If you don't, it'll still copy it. It just said it will fail to delete. This probably isn't going to be a problem working with private mailbox data, because generally you have permission to your own mailbox. It might have some significance if you're copying messages from a public folder, though. We haven't heard any negative feedback about this. And it's not that we can't implement it. It's that we didn't think to. And it wasn't until later we realized, you know, we didn't really implement that. It's kind of like a stream lock thing. We're just going to kind of wait and see if anybody notices. It simplified our design in the middle tier a lot by not having to actually do that, because we'd have to make multiple calls to the back end to validate every single message that we're going to serialize that we have permissions to actually do it. The speed thing, throughput. So that was kind of the distinction between a copy and a move. Sure. It's a good question. Now, the server obviously maintains the download context object, so that object has to know where it's at in the stream, so when the client comes back and asks for the next buffer, it knows where to resume from, like what message it was currently serializing, what property that it was currently serializing, where to start again. If the connection is severed, the fast transfer just stops. You can't resume from it. You could start over, but you can't resume. Now the client, you could implement a client to keep track of what messages were actually copied by parsing the stream. So if you got disconnected, you could theoretically reconnect and then just say, well, I know that I pushed those. I could just do another copy, fast transfer copy message with less messages. Because it is a requirement that the server has to serialize the messages in order that they're passed up in that list of messages. The other client uses the copy messages usually based off user action. The user drags and drops or does something. And if the connection is severed, it just fails and doesn't complete the operation. The user has to then do it again. The user will visually see that some messages were copied and some messages were not, and have to figure out how to do that on their own.
So basically, the same direction of this ICS, you have
Yes. As the data is being uploaded to the server, obviously, when it's parsing through it, when it gets to an end message marker, it will actually persist it at that time. Now, you could wait till you received all of it and then do it all at once. Although the caveat to that is if you have a client that's monitoring and deleting from the source, you could run into a problem where you have the data on the destination. The client might have already deleted the source, and for some reason if you can't save.
Yeah, so you presented like implementation data for these that's semantics of the protocol, right?
So sure. Yes, generally the markers are basically, it's kind of like a pseudo language. When the server or anybody's parsing it, when it hits that marker, there's definitely an action that needs to occur at that point.
I have a couple of questions about
sure.
parsing the fast transfer buffers.
Okay.
The splitting of properties.
Sure.
Between chain buffers, that's only between chain buffers, or can that also happen between get fast transfer buffer buffers?
That's a good question. When we did the, well, I think what you're saying is when we implemented the packing where you could have multiple response buffers in the same payload, this, like multiple 32K chunks, the splitting is the same whether it's breaking between those buffers or breaking between a physical another RPC call. So it's the same thing.
You're able to maintain state between.
You do. We thought about actually implementing it such that the client would then have to kind of piece all of them together before it actually started parsing because of the breaking, but we decided that it was easier for the server to just think that the client only is asking for 32K and or the 31680, sorry, and then just break like it would normally break there as though the client issued a single RPC. When we pack in additional ones, it's kind of like the client is making other RPC calls, but we're just giving them the response data without the client actually having to make those calls. So the breaking of the properties is the same whether it's between packed buffers or between RPC calls, or between ROMs.
And the other question I had is on the actual property tags.
Mm-hmm.
What if it's a lid instead of a tag? How does, for instance, if you're doing a transfer between stores,
sure,
the mapping of the lids would be different between stores?
It is true for named properties. The named properties could be different. Markers aren't named properties, so it would only be an actual property that would be a named property,
right,
that would fall into this. Now, in the fast transfer stream, the way that was worked out, I mean, it would be really ugly if the client had to download the data. You would have to get the named property tag, go map it off the source, then map it off the destination, and change the data in flight. So they resolved it by named properties actually have the full name property information in the data stream after it. So if the property tag is a named property, which is, I think, 8,000 hex or higher, following it is the actual full information for the named property, like the name property GUID, what type it is, whether it's a string or an ID, the ID or the string. I believe the other fast transfer document explains how that looks. That information, all of that is considered an atom, so it's always going to be there. So if you hit a named property, that information is always going to be there. Now what the server does, the source server, if you're passing it up to a server, he just gets that information, just looks it up in his own table, and he actually ignores the property value that's passed from the source server. He says, oh, I know it's a named property because it's 8,000 or higher. I'll get the named property information, remap it, and then use that value instead of the one in the stream. So ICS examples. I'm going to explain how a cache client knows when something in a folder is changed. The client could, I suppose, register for all notifications on the mailbox. That would be a bit chatty. You'd get a lot of notifications coming through. You would have to kind of sift through message change, all these different things to figure out what's going on. But it's a little bit, well, I wouldn't say easier, but a little bit different than that. So how does the client know to synchronize the folder? So what the client does is he creates a deep hierarchy table on the mailbox, which is essentially, it's a table that has a row for every folder within the mailbox. And he asks for very specific properties, folder level properties, on those folders, or on each folder. And then he kind of monitors those properties to see if they change. So, and based on whether those properties change, it knows, the client knows whether he needs to resynchronize individual folders. And then the client, of course, controls how aggressive it wants to synchronize the folders. Now, every single time one of these property changes and it realizes, oh, I need to sync this folder, he can immediately go sync the folder. But we found that if the client syncs too frequently, it's kind of chatty and it's very expensive on the wire. So what the client will typically do is it will say, oh, something in this folder's changed. It puts it in a queue, and I think it will only synchronize the folder once every 30 seconds. I think it's the base minimum. It won't synchronize it any faster than that. And of course, if you're implementing a client, you can do whatever you want. That's just kind of, I think, keep yourself from hammering the server if you have a folder or a mailbox that gets a lot of traffic. So in this example, there's a client connected to the server that's waiting for notifications. I sent a mail message to this mailbox, so it would be delivered into the inbox. And I've captured some network traffic with Network Monitor, and I use the RPX tool to examine the data. And it goes something like this. So when the client first connects, he wants to create this deep hierarchy table. The ROC release that's at the top there is grayed out because it's kind of insignificant in this example. Most ROC releases are just kind of deferred operations that the client will just throw into the request buffer, and they're just there. Some other prior object that was being released. But the key thing here is that it opens the root folder with the ROC open folder. And if you see here, the
proliferation on the output to initialize the sequence. Just the output. What's the proliferation output that can generate the sequence?
Just start output. In this particular example, I had already started Outlook. It kicked up, it synchronized the mailbox. And then I shut down the client, started it up again. This is from that trace. And then I just sent the message to the mailbox.
With a connection in cache mode, not online mode?
Cache mode, yes. Yes. In online mode, it doesn't do this. This is for cache mode only. In online mode, it actually, as you open folders, you have folders selected, it will actually register for specific notifications on that folder to know if, because it's working off tables at that point, right? It has a contents table that it's displaying, and it registers for notification on the contents table, so it knows if something's been inserted or added to the table. But in cache mode, since it's kind of not online mode, and you're not the client, you're viewing the OST, you're not really viewing the server, this is a way for the client to know when something on the server has changed. So it opens the root folder, and here the FID is 1-1. That looks a little suspect. But actually, we back up in time, we get up to 88 miles per hour, we go back in time, you'll find that in the ROC log on response that the root folder is actually 1-1. Since this is a 15 server, the IDs are now associated with the mailbox, so they look all nice and pretty like this. So when this mailbox was created, you can kind of see the order in which these folders were provisioned, basically the order in which the IDs exist. So, oh, yes, I wanted to highlight here that this example was taken Sunday at 2 a.m. Actually, this is GMT, so it was more like Saturday afternoon, so it wasn't that bad. Okay, so it opens the root folder, and then it issues a ROC get hierarchy table, and it passes the depth flag. And what this tells the server is you want a hierarchy table as deep as you can go. In exchange, I think in the MAPI specification for this flag, it says to go as deep as the server, the quiet language it says is as deep that is most practical or something, I don't know. But in exchange, on public or private folders, it'll do the whole hierarchy. Public folders, we don't support it because public folder hierarchies can be quite large. And if you created a deep hierarchy table on a public folder, it would probably never return. It's so long. I think this other flag, the suppressed notifications flag, I think there might actually be, there might be a bug in the RPX tool. I think the flag name is wrong, and I'll have to verify. It kind of sounds like we're asking the server to not give us any notifications on this table. That would be kind of weird.
I'll tell you what that is, Joe.
It's the suppressed notification on my actions, I believe, is what
it is. It suppresses notifications that are made on that connection.
Right. So What Bob was saying is that we added a flag to tell the server that, hey, if there's certain actions that this particular logon, say, if this logon creates a message and saves that message, any notifications produced by this logon, don't tell this object, don't tell this deep hierarchy table about it. Because a cache client, it really only wants to know when something's happened to the mailbox outside of its control. Right. So if he has a local modification in the client and he wants to replicate it at the server, he doesn't want the server to tell him about it. Because he's going to say, I just replicated something up. Oh, something in this folder's changed. I'm going to go download it. And of course, he's going to be downloading the thing that he passed up. So that was kind of wasteful. So I think the name here is wrong. I think it's suppress notifications on my action, the actual real name of that flag. But I'll verify and get the RPX tool changed. Okay, so in response, this actually is, let me back up here for a second. I think this is actually all in the same request. I think I've just broken it up here. So in the same request, following the get hierarchy table is set columns. Is this the set of columns that it wants on the hierarchy table? The set of columns is the folder ID, the display name, whether or not there's subfolders, the parent folder ID, this folder view info extended. I really have no idea what that property is. Deleted count total and local commit time max, folder flags, and hierarchy revisions. Now, the properties that are of importance for knowing when something in a folder has changed are those two properties. It's the deleted count total and the local commit time max. Now the other properties are there. The client uses them to know if something in the hierarchy has changed, whether it needs to resync the hierarchy. But the two that it uses to know if content in a folder has changed are those two. So if these properties change on that folder row or that row in the table for a specific folder, it knows that something in that folder has changed. Now the deleted count total is essentially the property that the server has to maintain that it's the total number of messages that have been deleted in the folder. And it's just a counter that just ticks up. So theoretically, you could go to a folder, it could be completely empty, or it could have messages in it. You can kind of get a pseudo history of how many messages did exist that had been deleted. So this is something that a server implementer would have to maintain, this property. And the PID tag local commit time max, this is actually a timestamp. It's the last timestamp of the last in exchange. It's the last time something was written into that folder. Whether a message was added, a message was modified, or the read unread state of a message has changed. On any message in the folder, it's the highest time value. So the client essentially keeps this table. It has all the prior values. It gets a table notification that one of these properties has changed. It says, oh, property's changed. It knows then it needs to schedule to sync that folder. And then, of course, it does query rows. It wants to read the table as it is when the client first loads. I don't believe it does any other queries on this table other than if you get disconnected, it has to recreate the table. It just gets the initial snapshot, and then it works for notifications at that point. So, this goes up to the server. This is the response. The response, the set columns comes back, completes. The query rows actually returns. In this particular example, there was 43 rows that were returned in this mailbox. So starting from a brand new mailbox that I never did anything with, there's 43 folders. It just seems like a lot of folders for a completely empty mailbox. But it is what it is. A lot of them are hidden folders. You don't see them. But the folder in this example is the inbox. So I show just row 15. Again, you see here the local commit time max that's returned is 1:52 a.m. That's the value of this value before the new message was delivered. And it also has a, since I didn't delete a folder, I'm not really, or delete a message, the deleted item count is 8 to start with. And this is the inbox folder. The display name tells you so. But in reality, the inbox folder, I believe its folder ID is up there. It's 14 or E, the inbox folder. So it has that initial list of folders. The only one that is for this example is the inbox. So I only highlighted that. So some time passes. The client's sitting there waiting for notifications. Newer clients will use the async RPC calls, waiting for notifications. Older clients might be using UDP if it's an older server. So then mail's delivered to the inbox. So what happens next? The first thing that happens is the server knows that it has a table that has a subscription subscribed to it for notifications, and something in that table has been modified. So it has to tell the client to update that table. So it produces an event, table change notification, which gets tagged to the logon. Since there's an event for that session, it will then, and there's a parked async wait call, it completes that asynchronous call. So the first thing, the client's sitting there, he's passive, he's just waiting for notifications. This call finally completes. The flags out property is one. It's telling the client there's notifications for you. If it was zero, it would mean I'm just completing the call. There's actually not really any notifications for you. I'm just completing the call. Just repark the call. But in this case, it returns one. The server's telling the client there's notifications or events. So the client will then just issue an ECDO RPC EXT2. It doesn't have to have a payload. In this particular example, there was this lingering ROP release that was in the request buffer. It was some previously released object. It was deferred. I grayed it out because it's not really important for this example. You could issue this with a completely empty request buffer. The server returns. There's no response for ROP release, so you don't see that in the response. It returns a ROP notified. This is how the Exchange server communicates to the client that there's a notification for a particular object. The notification handle is the actual object that's receiving the notification. It's 9. I believe that is our deep hierarchy table. It will be a table modified or table row modified. The table modified event, the particular type of event is a table row modified. And it actually gives information. It's the inbox folder. And it has a new local commit time max value. Before it was like 1:52 a.m. and now it's 2:10 a.m. So the client can compare it to the previous value and say, hey, something's been committed into this folder. I need to schedule a sync. So what does it do now? Now that it knows that it needs to synchronize this folder, what do you think the client does next? Synchronize the folder? Actually, it doesn't. It actually reparks the async call, the first thing that it does. It doesn't want to miss notifications. Before it actually does anything else, it just says, okay, I've retrieved all the notifications, now I need to repark this call so I can get more notifications. Now what does the client do? Okay, goes right into my next example, downloading a new message with ICS. Okay, so in this example, the client will initiate the download synchronization using the ROP synchronize configure operation. This is done on the folder in which it wants to synchronize. In this case, it will be the inbox folder. The server will return a synchronization download context object. It's very similar to the fast transfer download context object, but it's specific to synchronization. Or ICS, the client has to upload the previous state of its replication session with the server that it retrieved on the last synchronization session for that folder. The ICS state is specific to a folder. And it uploads it to the synchronization context object, and it uses the synchronization upload state stream begin, continue, and end to do that. And it will upload 4 separate state properties. And I'll show them an example here. And then the client will then ask for the server to start serializing those changes. And it uses the same fast transfer source get buffer operation. It uses it on the the synchronization download context object. So the context object receives all the information of what it wants to synchronize. It has the scope is the folder in which it's being requested on, and there's some other configuration flags in the synchronization configure operation to say what type of messages, whether you want deletes or read on read, and all that kind of information. And it also the download context object retrieves the previous state, so it knows what the prior state, it knows what the client currently has, so the server is able to compute the diff between what currently is on the server and what the client currently has. And then it can start serializing that data in response to the source GET buffer. And of course, when it's done downloading all the changes, the client will release the download context object with ROP release. You're writing a client, please do this. Okay, in this example, the client is going to synchronize the inbox folder after new mail arrives, NetMonitor, of course, and the RPX tool to examine the data. So what we see here is the client will open the inbox. The FID is 14 or E, that was the inbox folder from the log on. And then it will also issue this ROP synchronization configure in the same request. So the synchronization configure ROP is associated with the successful open of the inbox folder. Some things of note here is the synchronization type is content. So it's saying it wants to synchronize the contents of the folder. I think you either do contents or hierarchy. So this one is contents. It's telling the server that it wants all Unicode properties. Recover mode is if the server has any sort of failure serializing a message, that there's some markers or some metadata you put in their stream to tell the client, hey, there was a message that was skipped. There's also, it has the partial flag telling the server that if you determine that a message was already downloaded to the client, it was only partially changed, to just give me the partial message change. I don't have that in this example because this is a new message. I thought about adding it to this talk, but I think I would go way long, so I left it out. If anybody wants to know more information about partial item downloading, please let me know. I can write up something to get it to people, explain that in detail. It's in the document, but the document's kind of dry. There's something in the document you don't understand, let me know. There's a bunch of other flags here. Best body, the client wants the server to only download one body type, the best body type, and also wants it to give it some progress information as it's downloading the messages. And it also says it wants both normal messages and FAI messages. And FAI messages are those hidden folder associated information messages that Outlook doesn't display. They're messages like rules messages and things like that are actually hidden, that are actually in folders that you don't see them. So the client is just basically telling the server, I don't know what's changed, just download everything that's changed regardless of message, whether it's a normal message or an FAI message, just download it for free. In this particular case, there's no restriction on the synchronization. I believe you can pass up a restriction to say only synchronize messages that match this restriction. There is no restriction. The client just wants everything for the folder, for everything for that folder. It also has this extra flags. It's saying, in addition to the normal properties that I'll explain in the next slide, there's some header properties that come down with each message change. And download a set of properties that are specific to ICS. But in addition to those, to also actually return the MID and the current change number of the message. It's also telling the server to sort the messages by delivery time. Now, previously when, I think prior to Exchange 2003 or maybe 2003, ICS would always just synchronize everything in some, can conceptually say oldest to newest order, but we wanted the ability to download newest to oldest, because normally when you're setting up a mailbox and you're syncing for the first time, messages that are 5 years old are completely irrelevant to what you're doing, and you kind of want the newer messages to sync first. So there was this flag added to order by delivery time, and the order is it's not configurable, it's always newest to oldest. And there's also a list of properties that the client is telling the server, hey, don't give me these. Just exclude these properties from the output. I don't know where this list came from. Client implementation detail. Outlook client says, hey, don't give me these. They have their reasons. I don't know why. The server, of course, honors them, just strips them, at least I hope. So here in the same request as these two ROPs, it also passes up, I went back the wrong way. Okay, it also passes up the previous ICS state. And the ICS state consists of four state string properties. And the string properties are basically serialized sets of IDs. And in this particular property, it's the PID tag ID set given. So there's no data in the begin marker. It just says what property is being uploaded. The data is in the continue ROP. The continue ROP can actually be broken across multiple RPC calls. You can serialize up a large stream. And that stream is essentially a serialized representation of all of the messages, or an ID set of messages that have been previously downloaded to the client. And then the end marker tells the server that the client's done passing up that stream, and it can then digest that information and build whatever internal data structures it needs to represent that. And this will actually repeat. If you notice really subtly that the property tag will change, there's four of them, the next one, well, there's the data. Well, actually, I think I broke this out. I actually showed you, if you actually parse that, it tells you that the namespace is one, there's a particular namespace. If you back up here, the first 16 bytes is the namespace GUID, followed by the serialized data, and that breaks down to this. So the glob set ranges is, we've given to the client messages with mid values 1D through 1E, message 20, because it's singleton, messages 22 through 23, 25, and 2B through 30. So that essentially just tells the server the client has those set of messages in its folder. So now if you look closely, the PID tag ID set given now changes to CN set scene. It's a next property. ICS state property that's uploaded is uploaded in the same fashion. It's uploaded in the same request buffer. These are very small, so they all fit in 32K. Here, if you look at this, if you break it out, it actually looks like this. It's the same namespace ID, same namespace GUID, but the ranges of change numbers is between 1 and 366 hex. Change numbers are monatomically increasing across the mailbox. So if you synchronize with a folder, and you're completely done synchronizing with that folder, the server can optimally compress these ranges to just a single range, saying you have everything up between the beginning of time and what my current counter is. Because any new changes to that folder will get a change number that's higher about it. And it uses the CN set scene to determine, it gets this property from the client. It knows that the current client has everything 1 through 366, then it could just check the folder. Is there any messages in this folder that have a higher change number? And if they do, that message needs to be downloaded. So the next one is CN set scene FAI, and this is a change number list of all of the hidden or the folder associated information messages. If you break it out, it actually is the same thing. It's just as the server it may not have downloaded an FAI message in the last synchronization session, but it always just keeps bumping that counter up. Because it knows if any FAI message was modified after that moment, we get a higher change number. So it compresses very, very much like the CN set scene. And of course, the last one is the CN set red. And this is essentially a set of changes the server uses to evaluate read and unread changes on the folder. Now, like the change number property on each message is also a read unread change number property that's also stored on each message. So it independently keeps track of message changes versus just read unread changes. And this basically is the same thing. It's all compressed nicely. The last time it synced, the highest value was 366. If there's any other red on red changes, they would get a higher value associated with them. So that all goes up to the server. Well, the last drop in this request buffer is, of course, the get buffer. It said, I've created the object. Well, I want you to create the object. I've passed up the previous state. Now give me the first response buffer. Of course, it uses babe. It asks for 31680. And then the server deliberates, does its thing, and evaluates the current state of the message in the inbox compared to the ICS state properties that were uploaded. And every new changed message must be assigned a new change number value of a higher value. Well, I think that's true. You could say that. So the server then can then, it builds a list of messages whose change number values are higher than what's seen in both either CNSetScene or CNSetScene.fai. And now it has this list of messages it needs to serialize and return to the client.
Does it also loop into edges if something is missing from edges?
Yes, of course. If you passed up a state stream that had a CNSet, I mean, it's just a set of ranges. And this example here that range was optimally compressed between beginning of time and the last value when it's synchronized. Now, of course, the client, if it wants to do its own tricks, could say, I don't know, if you wanted to re-download a message, you could remove a change number out of the list, or that the ranges could be broken up. The server will honor it. If there's a change number in the middle that's missing, and it'll download that item again. Now you have to get kind of tricky because change numbers are cumulative. A message might be changed once and it has one value, and it could be changed again and it has a new value. If you remove the previous value, it can't go back in time to synchronize an older. It's not a revisioning store, so it can't do that.
It's worth noting, Joe, the practical example of checkpointing, which is optimizing for terrible networks. As we commit items into the store, stash off the bid of those items, the dual stream, and commit it every so often. Then if either your connection drops or your client blows up, when you come back, if that stream is there and has bids in it or CNs, then you can actually, Joe gave you a removal example, but you can also add things to that block.
Sure. What Bob is saying is that you have the previous state that the client has persisted, it knows. But then when it goes to the server and it says, okay, here's my previous state, now give me everything that's changed. Now, the server is going to start serializing those messages. And as it's parsing that stream, and as it's getting those messages within that stream, as it gets to the end message marker, it can say, okay, now I've committed that. And what the client does, what Bob is saying is the output client, it's smart. It does its client-side, what we call client-side checkpointing. It says, I have the previous state, and now as I committed this message, I know the message mid, and I know the change number. I'm going to go with temporarily. I'm just going to add that to the previous state by adding the ID to the ID set given and adding the change number to the CN set C. So that if the connection is dropped or broken, when it reconnects, when he goes back to the server, he's going to pass a modified ICS state up to the server. So the server will continue kind of where it left off. So if you're downloading large items, you don't have to just re-download all those items again. It will just kind of continue where it left off. You say that again?
This optimization, is it only always driven by the output, or it could be that the server also comes to the output?
Well, since the output, I mean, the server creates these download context objects, but it doesn't, these objects are just kind of in memory, they're not persistent. I mean, if the client gets disconnected, these objects get cleared and deleted, and it really has no concept of any prior outlook or client connection or serialization state or any of that. So when the client reconnects, he essentially reopens a folder, builds the context object, has to upload the state. So in this example, it's the client that's keeping track of that. Now, client doesn't have to. It's just that if you're downloading a lot of data in a kind of a noisy network environment, like a laptop, and you're going in and out of range, you don't really want to be re-downloading the same items all the time. Now, the server, when it's done downloading all the message changes, will give you the final state, and it's kind of tacked on to the end of the fast transfer stream after all the message changes. It'll give you the updated state properties, and then the client will then just say, okay, well, it just throws out its checkpointing state, and it just saves what the server has. Because the server will go in and actually optimally compress some of those, like the CN set, it will compress them, compress those ranges. The client might not be able to do that because change numbers are kind of are disjoint within a folder, but overall across the mailbox, you can compress it into one set. But within that folder, as they're assigned, they might have a lot of gaps. So as the client's building this checkpoint state, the CN set scene could get fragmented. So the client wants to eventually, when it's done synchronizing all the messages, throw away its checkpoint state and save or come back to the server. So in the response here, you'll see, I didn't actually include any of the data because there's a lot of ROPs, but you'll see a response to the open folder, the synchronization configure, the four sets of begin, continue, end for each of the state stream properties. Those all come back in the response, and then, you get the first fast transfer source get buffer. And in this particular case, it succeeded, and it returned about 7K of data. And you'll notice the done flag is there. It means there's no more data. This is it. There was just one new message, and it wasn't a very big message.
Joe, a question.
Sure.
On the very first synchronization, if you have no data,
sure.
Do you still see those upload state begin, end, or begin, continue, end with null values, or do you just omit them?
I believe the client actually passes them up with empty values. There was a requirement that I think that the server has to return them, or the client has to pass them up. I can't remember. I think we explained it in the aux, the MS aux C FX ICS document. It explains which properties have to exist, which direction, whether the server's returning the final state or the client's passing them up. But I believe they're passed up, they're just empty. Yeah. The client doesn't have to build an empty set of ranges with namespace goods. It doesn't need to know any of that. It just says, here's the property, its length is zero. I don't think you even need to include the continue method. I think you just go straight from begin to end. Don't quote me on that, I think. Okay, so it's going to return about 7K of data. So the RPX tool will actually parse out this information kind of like it did for fast transfer. It kind of breaks it down between the different markers and properties. Here we have, at the very beginning of the stream, we have this InkerSync progress mode. You notice in the synchronization configure there was the progress flag. What this tells the server is the client wants this progress information kind of interwoven in the output stream. And the first block, this InkerSync progress mode block, is actually an accumulative total of all of the messages that will be downloaded. It includes the total FAI message count that it's going to download. It includes the total number of normal messages it's going to download. It's going to return the accumulated size of each of those. So the server has to be able to produce this list ahead of time, know all the sizes of the messages to be able to return this information. And that's what the progress flag is. The client uses this information mainly, I think, now just for updating a progress bar or a status bar so the end user know kind of where they're at in the synchronization session.
Does that require a lot of processing when the synchronization works?
Building the list of messages and knowing how many messages and what type is easy. There's some question about whether it's costly for it to determine the message size. I believe the server, when you save a message, it computes the size and then stamps it as the PID tag message size. And all this is doing here is it's just reading those properties and then just adding them up. Here there is one message, and it's roughly, I don't know, whatever that size is, it's in hex. I guess if you look just down below, it's 5K. So So there's some overhead in the stream, obviously. I think that the data said it was about 7K, but the message size is saying it's about 5K. So there's some overhead. So the next marker, this is a marker that you'll find at the beginning of every message change. The first one was, it's always at the beginning of the stream, and it's kind of the sum total of all changes. This is a marker that'll be at the beginning of every message change. And it's a per message, the ink or sync progress per message. And it's essentially just the size of the message that's following. And let me go back up. And it has this message after FAI. This is something else I need to get to change in the RPX tool. But that value is really, it's a Boolean, and it says whether or not the message is FAI. It's false in this case, so I think that the name should probably be changed. I don't know if message after FAI really kind of leads you to believe what that value actually is. So I will get the RPX tool changed. Now, the reason why we want to do the per message progress is, you know what the sum total of all the messages being downloaded, and you know the sizes of the messages that were previously downloaded. You kind of keep track of where you are in the stream. Now, granted, if you were downloading one message and it's very large, it doesn't give you a whole lot of information because you know the size of that one message and you're told the size again, but everything after it is just a message. Now, Outlook does a pretty good job. It does some estimations. It says, okay, this message is 5K as it's reading data. I mean, if the message was much larger, it would say, this message is 20 megs. It kind of keeps track of the size of the message data and it tries to update that progress as best it can. Users kind of get cranky when progress bars go blomp, blomp, and they're done. So they kind of want to see some smooth progress. So the next marker is basically telling the client that I have a change for you, and it's ink or sync change. And there's a set of fixed properties that must follow this in this order. It has to have the source key, the last modification time, the change key, the predecessor change list, whether or not the message is associated, that's the FAI flag again. It's that same bool. And then you notice that it has the PID peg mid and change number. Those are optional properties based off of the extra configuration flags inside of the synchronization config drop. Since the client asks them, the server returns them. And the reason why the client asks for those is so that it can do client-side checkpoint. It knows what the mid is for this message, and it knows the change number for this message. So when it gets done downloading that message, it knows it can update those states in the client. And I think that's what I'm trying to highlight there. Oh, yeah. It's an 8-byte value, and mids and change numbers are kind of in a really weird order. It looks kind of funny when you dump it like this and dump a 64-bit value this way, but if you actually convert it properly, it's actually namespace 1, the ID is 31 hex, and the change number is namespace 1, the change number is 368. And you remember from the previous states, the highest change number is 366, so the server saw this change number of 368 and knew it needed to download it. Okay. Following the EagerSync change and those fixed properties is another marker to say, okay, here's the actual message itself that's following. And that's what you get with this marker here, EagerSync message. Here's the message. There's a ton of properties I removed. I only left in two just so you would see them. Message class, it's a regular message. And the subject was Exchange RPC Plugfest. And all the other properties were removed. You also notice there's this, we call it a meta property. It's not really a marker and it's not really a property. We call it a meta property, for lack of a better name. It basically is telling the person who's parsing this that it's requesting at that moment that whoever's parsing it do some operation on the object. In this particular case, it's telling the client to delete any message recipients that the message object might have. Now, it's kind of funny since this is a new message that's being downloaded, why it would want it to delete them. It's just the server's kind of brain dead. It doesn't know if this is a changed message or a new message. If it was a changed message, it's just telling the client, hey, you've opened this message, you've applied the properties, now go and just delete the recipient table because I'm going to give you all the recipients. So it tells the client, delete the recipient table or all recipient information, and then it comes in and it starts the first recipient. A lot of the recipient properties were also removed because of lack of size, and just kind of left some, so you get a kind of an idea. The recipient is the to address, I believe, and the message that was sent to the mailbox was the administrator account mailbox, so the name is administrator, it's an exchange email address. The rest of the properties were removed, and then you get the end recipient, so the client knows, okay, this is a full recipient, it could persist the recipient on the message. And then it goes in, following recipients is always a list of attachments that are on the message. So the client, once again, is brain dead. It doesn't know if this is a new message or a change message. Just telling the client, delete any attachments that might be on the message because I will give you attachments following this. But in this example, there is no attachments on the message, so there's nothing following it. Okay. That was the entire message change that came down to the client. You'll notice that there was no begin message, end message like you do in fast transfer, or start message, end message. In ICS, essentially, go back the slide, you have the interesting message. That's kind of your start message. You have all the message properties, you have any meta commands, recipients, attachments. The client kind of needs to know where he is when he's parsing, because if he reads a next atom, it happens to be a marker starting something else in the stream, he needs to know, I was just working on a message change. I better go save that. So there's no nice marker that says, okay, this is the end of the message, go do some operation. He just has to know that when he's parsing, oh, I've got to another marker, and now I'm transitioning into returning the final state. He needs to know that if I was working on something prior, I need to finish that up. So it makes building some sort of state machine a little not as easy. Okay, so the next thing in the data stream is the actual final ICS state properties that the server finishes up with. Now this state will represent everything that was just downloaded to the client. It's the accumulation of the state that was passed up and then all the changes that were downloaded. So it's the final state giving back to the client. The server downloads them in slightly different order. It passes the two CN set scenes first, then the ID set given, and then the red. I don't think there's any real strict ordering here. I think the server can return them in any order. I know the client doesn't care which order. So you see the increasing state begin that says, okay, I'm returning the state information. You see the CN set scene property, and it's a binary property, so it contains the serialized set of that state property. And you'll notice this is what it was before. It was 1 through 366. And now that we just downloaded that message that was 368 change number, changes to 36C. Something else on the server had changed during that time, but this is just returning one through the highest value for that mailbox, for that namespace, so for changes. But it includes 368 that was on the message, so if the client reused this new state, it won't get that same change back. For the CN set scene FAI, it's the same thing. It started with 366, it returns 36C. Even though it didn't return an FAI message, it knows that it's processed all changes up to a certain point. So there's no point, you go ahead and advance the counter there too. And now you have the ID set given. Previously was this. And if you remember from a previous slide, the message ID was 31. So it just nicely changes that to 31. So now we know that we have that message ID. The CNSet red is the same thing. It started at 366, and now it changes to 36C. And then nicely, there's an end marker for the sync state. I don't know why we don't do it for message changes, but we do it for the state. We have an end marker that says, OK, that's the end of the state. And then there's a final marker that says, this is the end of the synchronization session. There's nothing after this. And that's basically how the message is downloaded.
This state represents the old one that I had before?
Yes. The client will generally manipulate it during the synchronization session up until the point it receives the final state. And when it receives the final state, it just gets rid of the one that it was manipulating and saves the new one. Anything else? I know there's questions out there. Actually, nothing. It's just the server keeps track of how many open objects you have. And because of resource issues, we limit the number of open objects you can have on a logon and on a connection. We limit the number of logons. We limit the number of folder objects, message objects, synchronization objects that it, not only on a logon, but I think we actually limit them on the server per user. So if you don't release them, you could run into a case where you try to open an object, you do an open folder, and you get a failure. I think we have EC max object seeded or something. So you're going to eventually going to run into problems where you'll run out of objects. So for a given client. Now, I think with Exchange 2010, I think we might keep that. I could be wrong, but I think we keep it for users. So even if you open multiple connections, if you're leaking on one, it could adversely affect any of the sessions. The limits are set pretty high because a typical user will have like an Outlook client open. They might have an OAuth session. They might have a link or desktop search tool, a lot of different things using the protocol. Right, so a lot of different logons, a lot of different objects open. But if it's, the limits are set pretty high. Like folders is like 500 and 100 of this, 500 of that. But if your client is leaking, you'll know right away, especially if it's a sync client where you're syncing all the time. If you don't properly release something, you will hit that error. And if you hit that error, it generally just typically means I'm not releasing something somewhere. Somewhere in my code, I'm opening something, but I'm failing to release it. Other than operations will just start failing. So. Okay. Last chance. In 2010, I don't think there was a whole lot of new functionality added. The difference between 2010 is that we kind of rewrote this protocol interface layer. So there was a lot of things where might have previously worked on an older version, but it doesn't work on this version, like the locking of streams is an example. The move flag is another example. I think functionally for what Outlook uses and what Communicator or Link or Desktop Search or most tools use, the functionality is there. There's some, might be some corner case stuff that is slightly different. I don't think we added any additional functionality to the protocol. I could be wrong. There may be a flag here and there, but not off the top of my head. I can't think of anything. We didn't add any ROPs that I believe. Alrighty then. I'll be available all week, so if you have any questions the remainder of this week, feel free. I might not physically be here in this building, but ask Virginia or somebody else, and they could have me come over. All right.